In the summer of 2011, I went to Madagascar, and I'm just going to give you sort of a brief overview of the study that I worked on, and then tell you a little bit about my experience and challenges. I kind of talk more about the study, so I'm sorry I'm not talking as much about my experience, but I find it really interesting, so I wanted to share that. So first, I just have to say I was working on a USAID-funded project, but they do not endorse this presentation, or it doesn't reflect any of their views. They're mine. So as I said, in June 2011, I went to work on the Strengthening and Accessing Livelihood Opportunities for Household Impact Program. It's a program in Madagascar. They're working in the south, central, eastern, and southeastern region, and they're responding to chronic food insecurity. It's a consortium of ADRA, CRS, CARE, and Land O'Lakes. So it's the Land O'Lakes Foundational Fund. So I actually, the way I got the internship was that I knew the program director. I had worked for her when I was a Peace Corps volunteer. So I just emailed her and asked her if she had anything going on. And she told me that in 2009, they did a baseline survey in Madagascar, and they found that stunting rates were highest in the Central Plateau region, which is that central darkest region. And this was consistent across other studies that had been done in Madagascar, and consistent with the Demographic and Health Survey of 2008. So stunting is low height for age. It's children that are too short for their age. And it was, people were really surprised by this finding because in the central region, they have the lowest risk factors. They have more access to foods that are dietary, that are diverse, and they also are less prone to natural disasters, but along the coast, they're really prone to natural disasters. So nobody knows why if someone's higher. So she asked me to come and look at this. So I got there, and you know, I was kind of all gung-ho, and yes, I'm going to figure out why. and then I went to talk to the nutrition advisor at UNICEF, and she's like, you can't figure this out in 3 months. You know, this is going to take a longitudinal study. You probably have to do a cohort study or case control, you know, over years, because stunting happens more slowly than severe forms of malnutrition. So I went back and talked to, I was working in partnership with the health coordinator of the program, and I went back and kind of were like, okay, we have to regroup. And I had done a lit search in the first 2 weeks on the risk factors for stunting. I had done all this work, had reanalyzed the baseline data, but we were like, okay, what are we going to do? And so then we started talking, and we were thinking, okay, well, what do people in the central region actually think about, you know, what do these community members think about stunting? Do they even recognize it as a problem? Do they see malnutrition as a problem? And so we decided to just do a qualitative study and do focus groups and just kind of get a sense of what people were thinking instead of kind of our view of what we saw as the problems. And so we did focus group discussions. We worked with mothers, fathers, and grandmothers, and we split people into groups according to their child's height for age nutritional status. So if the child was stunted, all those mothers were together, or fathers, grandmothers, and then we have groups of non-stunted children. And then we also stayed with families while we went to all of these villages. So we did that over 2.5 weeks. So what we found were that people recognized malnutrition as a problem. However, they said, yes, there are children that are small, that are chronically malnourished. They didn't say chronic, but they called them children without food. That's the Chansakafo is the local language. But they talk more about these children on the left and right. So those are two types of severe malnutrition. The child on your left, has marasmus. That's not a child from Madagascar. That was the picture just to show you all. It's characterized by really skinny arms. You can see all their ribs. And they had a name for that. And then they also had a name for the child on your left, not on your right, which is a child experiencing kwashiorkor, and that's characterized by swelling of the hands and feet. And that was really interesting. They said, you know, there's something wrong with this child. When you touch their skin, something's not right. We can't explain it. But in scientific terms, they call it edema. And, you know, they recognize all of this stuff. And they recognize that as having an impact on their household, because that's when they had to go to the hospital. That's when they couldn't go to work and had to stay at home. But kind of just the chronic forms of malnutrition, they didn't recognize as such a large problem. And then we asked about perceived causes of stunting. And they did recognize stunting. The way we asked about stunting was we asked whether children that are the same age, but one is shorter than the other and just doesn't seem to grow as much. And they were like, yeah, well, that definitely happened. And they said it was caused by genetics. And so to further kind of explore this issue, we said, well, are there children whose parents are tall, but, you know, the child's really short? And they said, oh, yeah, that exists too. And they had a name for it. And they said that was caused by lack of resources, too much work for pregnant mothers, children going to work too early, and short birth intervals. And during our observations, we saw a lot of mothers with children that, you know, the children seemed to be a year or less apart. We saw one severe case. So it definitely happened, and they said that was frequent. So then we asked about how you could prevent malnutrition and stunting. And they said a lot of people did a lot of basket weaving and made hats and mats. So they said to increase their income-generating activities, to improve their hygiene, collaborate between the mother and father. They said a lot of times that caused malnutrition when mothers and fathers would fight. Birth spacing and family planning, improved nutrition for pregnant mothers, exclusive breastfeeding. Some of the things that they said that were kind of all the educational messages that we would always give, we think some of that might have been from previous NGOs working there or us working there. There was definitely some knowledge transfer going on. But they also said improve nutrition for children and to improve dietary diversity. But they defined dietary diversity as adding potatoes to rice. So, you know, there was still a lot to learn and to kind of work on. And the income-generating activities was actually really interesting, because then we asked about obstacles to prevention. And people said that, you know, there's a lack of time, and working mother has no time. A lot of grandmothers told us moms just don't have time they don't have time to wash their children's hands. They have to rush to the fields and then come home and make mats and make hats, and people just don't have time. And then when they leave their children with the older siblings, they don't know if the older siblings are washing the younger sibling's hands. If the mother left food for the younger sibling, they don't know if the older sibling ate it and didn't give it to the younger sibling. They also said husbands don't always accept family planning, and that the mother and father, they don't always work as a team. And then they also said they didn't have enough seeds and material to generate more income and produce healthy and necessary foods. So our conclusions for the study were that stunting wasn't perceived as a widespread problem. Secondary income was possibly a problem. It was in the baseline survey when we analyzed the data. We did find an association between stunting and secondary income, and that it seemed like the likelihood of being stunting was higher for people who had secondary sources of income. But the amount of people who only had one source of income was very small. Other things we thought were relating to the secondary income was that, and the dietary diversity, were that people grew a lot in this region. It was very fertile, and they grew lots of vegetables, but it was kind of the breadbasket of Madagascar, so kind of everything was going out. And tourism is really big, so that could be part of the problem, that it's all going to kind of hotels and touristy areas. And then just briefly on infant and young child feeding practices, it was really interesting. We found that some women did report discarding colostrum, which is the first milk that a mother has, and a child should get it within, ideally, the first hour of birth. And they said it was unclear how much they discarded, but they said it's just dirty, and they couldn't explain why it was dirty. But that was really interesting, because it seemed like a practice that was kind of being phased out, and it was really interesting to see that you know, to be there at the time when something's changing and evolving. They also give coffee and tea to really young children, children as young as 2 months old. They give coffee and tea to ward off illnesses, kind of the illnesses that they described as malnutrition. And they also talk a lot about convulsions and that children, they had to give them coffee and tea to avoid convulsions. And then alcohol, they didn't give children alcohol, but they reported that mothers drank alcohol during pregnancy, that they craved alcohol. And that was also because it was focus groups, it was always some mothers do this and some, you know, it was hard to kind of know how many, you know, how prevalent it was. And I think it might have also been causing problems because men in the villages also drank a lot. They had a local brew that they made, and we would see, there was one focus group discussion, and the guy was sitting far across from me, and I could smell alcohol on his breath, and it was 8 a.m. So a lot of people said that they would drink to cut hunger, because it was cheaper. So those are some of the things we learned that were interesting and things that we hadn't thought about. So we were able to kind of provide some recommendations to the program. So personally, this is kind of a funny picture, but the impact for me was that I went and everybody told me, I had been in the Peace Corps, they were like, you don't need to do an international practicum, and you know, it costs a lot of money, you don't have to do it, and I was like, well, I kind of have this limited view of just West Africa, and you know, I haven't seen outside of that, and I'm glad I went because it gave me a lot of perspective. The first 3 weeks, I think I was like, well, in West Africa they do this, in West Africa, you know, and kind of comparing a lot. But eventually, I was able to kind of take off my West African blinders and kind of see different things and just think about things differently, and how, you know, really see how, and I had seen it when I was in West Africa, but just how much culture is a part of all of the problems in public health that we face. I remember, so the region I was in was very fertile, and I remember seeing all these rice fields and thinking, I had lived in northern Mali, so I was like, oh, if they were here, they would grow so much stuff, the women in my village from Mali, and then I thought, no, they probably just grow their staple millet because that's what people are used to, so kind of, just always remembering that and how much culture is tied in. But I think it was also a challenge because I was only there for such a short amount of time. And I had previously, I had been in places where I was able to take a lot of time to get to know it and learn the language, learn the local language. And I felt lost a lot of times in Madagascar. So kind of how, you know, and I still struggle with that. How will I approach development knowing that I can't live the way I lived as a Peace Corps volunteer. And then my practical skills were just that I was able to implement a study from beginning to end, which is really awesome. I designed and developed the study protocol. I submitted the terms of reference. I analyzed and reported results. I worked under two great mentors and hopefully was able to benefit the program a little. The health program manager was able to spend 2.5 weeks in the village with me, and he never gets to be away from the capital for that long because he has so many demands in the capital. So he learned a lot about the program and how it was being implemented. And I just wanted to thank Jen Peterson and Jules Zecca. They were my counterpart. Well, they were kind of my mentors there. The field agents that did translation and the community health agents that kind of organized a lot of things and the participants of the study. That's all.